Thanks to everyone for coming out this Sunday afternoon at 5 o'clock, and thanks to those who download these as podcasts from iTunes. We invite your correspondence, comments, and feedback by emailing us at utahchristianist@gmail.com. We also have a membership class online at our website, utahchristianist.org. I'd like to thank those who become members. We couldn't do what we do without your help and support. Everything is inspired by the teachings of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who is the founder Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Before we launch into our theme, sometimes we tell something a little funny to relax you, get your creative juices flowing. So I heard about this lady. She arrived at the airport in New York as a tourist, and she hailed a cab at the airport. And when she got into the cab, she noticed the cab driver was slightly more formally dressed than most cab drivers. He had black pants, a white shirt, and he had his jacket folded on the seat beside him. So she got in the back seat and she told him the address where she wanted to go. So they drove and drove and drove for some time. Not a single word was exchanged, one to the other. On the way, she remembered a tourist destination. It wasn't too far off course, and she wanted to ask the driver if he could just make a slight little detour. They could see it on their way to her destination. So she reached from the back seat and she tapped the driver on the shoulder, and he went, "Oh!" And he jerked the steering wheel and crossed the center lane and almost ran into the oncoming traffic. Then he overcorrected and turned it all the way to the left, jumped up on the curb, knocked a whole bunch of newsstands off, finally came down off the curb, bounced a few times, got everything straightened out, and he's like breathing very heavily, shaking like a leaf in the wind. And he says, "Ma'am, I'm so sorry that happened, but I have to tell you, this is my first day as a New York City cab driver. Before this, for 25 years, I drove a hearse." Today our theme is getting a vision for the future. Here's something I ran across while I was preparing this talk. It was a compilation of quotes by Stephen Covey, who's a fellow Utahn. But he's quoting Viktor Frankl, an Austrian psychologist who survived the death camps of Nazi Germany. Frankl made a startling discovery about why some people survived the horrible conditions and some did not. He looked at several factors: health, vitality, family structure, intelligence, survival skills. Finally, he concluded that none of those factors was primarily responsible. The single most significant factor, he realized, was a sense of future vision. The impelling conviction of those who were to survive that they had a mission to perform, some important work to do. Survivors of POW camps in Vietnam and elsewhere have reported similar experiences. A compelling, future-oriented vision is the primary force that kept many of them alive. Studies have shown that we move towards that which we consistently see. We need to constantly put reminders in our life of the promises that Krishna has embedded within us. When we were young, we were more aware of those promises. We were more convinced that we were going to make a difference. But as we had to go to school, and then we got married, and we got a family, we pursued our career, we became more absorbed in imminent concerns: feeding my family, feeding my career, feeding my bank balance. And some or other, we segued from making a difference into settling into making a living. But we need to keep those dreams alive. While making concessions to the daily needs, we still cannot allow them to eclipse the dreams that God put in our hearts. If we do that, we're no better than the animals. The animals are just living from day to day, eating, sleeping, mating, defending, and they have no vision for the future. That's what distinguishes us. So a human being, however sophisticated he may be, driving in a motor car, sleeping in a waterbed, eating at the best restaurants, defending himself with nuclear weapons, if that human being is just eating, sleeping, mating, defending, and nothing more, albeit in a more sophisticated fashion, they're not considered, according to Vedic standard, human beings. They're called dvipada pashu, two-legged animals. So that's what distinguishes us as humans, to know that we're not our own creators. Someone else created us. There's an intelligent designer, and everything is created for a purpose. So we need to consult him and get into sync with that particular purpose. Prabhupada, our guru, in 1922, he met his guru, Bhaktisiddhanta. And at that first meeting, Bhaktisiddhanta asked him to go to the Western countries and preach Bhagavad Gita. But he was a young man. He was just starting a family. He was just starting a career. So there wasn't any question of his doing that in the immediate future. But he kept that vision in front of him. He kept himself prepared. Even while maintaining a family, even while doing a job, he would often go to the temple. He would often worship. He would donate. And being impressed with his devotion, the full-time monks in the temples would ask him quite often to give lectures and even to write poetry in praise of the mission and the spiritual master. He became known as Kavi, or the poet, amongst his peers. And often he would read this verse in the Bhagavad Gita, Vyakmishatmika Buddhi, Ega Kurunandana, Bahushakaya Nantascha, Buddhi Avivashaina. He said, those who never achieve the potential that God intends for them, their intelligence is many branched. It's splayed all over the place. They're prone to distractions. But those who are going to achieve their full potential and become everything that God intends for them, their intelligence is focused. They have a clear, focused vision of the future. And it was finally 1922. It was 1965, 43 years later, not having lost his focus, kept things in front of him to remind him of his ultimate mission. He arrived in America in 1965, having gotten a free ticket on a steamship with books that he had been writing and printing all along in India. No connections, no money, had two heart attacks on the way over, but he had a vision. And it's interesting, because his guru, Bhakti Saranda, had previously sent younger, stronger, more well-connected monks to Europe to do the same thing. They stayed 2 or 3 years and then came back, admitting failure, because they didn't have a vision. But yet this 70-year-old man in ill health, because he had a vision, it more than compensated for the other things that he lacked. Prabhupada once joked, there were all these well-trained young 2-year-olds lined up in the starting gates for the Kentucky Derby. And there was an old mare, an old gray mare, nearby looking out saying, let me try. Got an extra starting gate for me to get in there? Let me try. So Prabhupada compared himself to an old gray mare compared to the 2-year-olds, the Kentucky Derby favorites and attendees. But because he had a vision, he succeeded where others failed. Mr. Rubens, an elderly Jewish man, reminisces about some conversations he had with Prabhupada in Lower East Side Park in New York. Even after Prabhupada arrived, there was no visible signs of success for a year. So Mr. Rubens and Prabhupada would sit on this park bench, and Prabhupada would tell Mr. Rubens about all the devotees, all the disciples, all the temples, all the books, all the festivals they're going to. And Mr. Rubens like, really? I mean, really? He couldn't see any sign of that. He just saw another elderly gentleman like himself with not a whole lot to do. But Prabhupada said, yes, they're there, only time separates us. And that vision came to pass. Finally, Prabhupada attracted a few followers, and they were just hippies. A few weeks earlier, they'd been smoking, they'd been dropping acid, smoking pot. And they had no vision for themselves. They had no direction. Of course, Prabhupada had enough vision for the whole world. And he founded, at that time, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. It wasn't an international society. It didn't even affect New York City. It didn't even affect the East Village. It was just a few misfits. In fact, what people would do, they would stay up all, not his disciples, but the people that would frequent the temple, they would stay up all night having taken acid, and then they would come for breakfast in the morning. That was basically the constituency. And under those conditions, Prabhupada founded the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. It wasn't even the International, it wasn't even the East Village Society for Krishna Consciousness. It had no visible impact even in the local neighborhood, in the local suburb. And he had a reminder. He had a reminder of what his vision, of where he wanted to go. And that reminder was a globe. It was a globe. And he would spin that globe and he would stop at Japan. And he would say, Sudama, who just stopped smoking 3 days ago, is going to be our man in Japan. And he'd spin a little bit more and they'd say, Gargamuni, who doesn't even know how to tie his shoes, is going to found our mission in India. And Brahmananda is going to go to Africa. And Shivananda is going to go to Germany. Prabhupada said, I never had any small plans. for spreading Krishna consciousness. Because Krishna is not a small God. He creates millions and millions of universes. So he's a big God, and we should have big plans. And we're not inconveniencing Krishna by believing big things of him. Just the opposite. When you take the limits off of God, God is pleased. If you dream big, he'll honor that dream, he'll take that dream, and he'll supersize that dream. His dream for our life is bigger than our own. Now, Prabhupada could have thought, I'm an old man, I don't have any money, I'm in ill health. There are stronger, more fit people that have gone before me. In the natural, it didn't seem as if he had much chance of success. Nobody would have certainly bet on his success. But he knew that Krishna is a supernatural God. And with Krishna, anything is possible. We wouldn't be here today if Prabhupada hadn't had big dreams of honoring Krishna. If you have big dreams for honoring a big God, he will honor your dreams in return. When Vi and I had this vision to build a world-class Rajasthani temple in, of all places, Spanish Fork, Utah, we had 1 3-cent piece of paper to remind us of where we wanted to go. We had no money. We didn't have the land. It was next door, but we didn't have ownership of the land. We had nothing but a 3-cent piece of paper. But that 3-cent piece of paper had Vaibhavi's artist's conception of the temple. And we would, when we had nothing, no prospects, no constituency, no hope of building the temple, not even the land, not the money, we would repeatedly look at that paper. And that would awaken and stretch and enlarge our faith. And that would activate God in our lives. The first thing we needed to do was to acquire this 8.5 acres of land on which the temple sits. And the owners had just lowered the price by $35,000. So it was going to go fast. Now they wanted a $25,000 deposit, and we had $17,000. We had to raise $8,000 in a hurry because it was going to be snapped up pronto. So in those days, llamas were very much in demand, and there was a quite, according to law of supply and demand, llamas were fetching pretty decent prices. We routinely sold female llamas for $4,000 and $5,000, but we needed $8,000. So if you're from Utah, you're familiar with the Summer Haze chain of music stores owned by Bryant Summer Haze. We get a call one day. He's looking for a female llama to buy. Can he come and visit? I said, sure. So we had a llama who is the Krishna color, the color of a monsoon cloud during the rainy season. And the name for that in Sanskrit is Sham, and we had called this llama Shamin, the feminine. And we're looking over, leaning on the fence. Brian's here. This one's 4,000, this one's 5,000, this one's 4,500. And Brian only had eyes for the Krishna-colored llama. He didn't even look at the other one. He said, how much is that llama? And just like, without even thinking, I just blurted out $8,000. He wrote a check for $8,000 right on the spot. So we had the land. Then we had no money. We'd spent everything on the deposit. I remember I was in a running club in those days. On Saturday morning, we'd go 15 or 20 miles and we'd go down Treeline Road right here at the bottom of Harry's Hill. So there are about 20 runners, men and women, and we're jogging along at a pretty good pace. And someone says, true, here you're going to build a temple. And I said, yeah, we are. How much you got saved? How much you got in the bank to build this temple? I said, $5,000. So like 30 runners, marathoners, good cardiovascular, they all stopped like someone had hit them in the stomach and knocked the wind out of them. They said, say again? You meant 50, right? You meant 500,000, didn't you? 150,000? No, I said $5,000. So we had this dream, we had this vision. We showed this piece of paper to the Daily Universe, the BYU paper. They printed it. And the article was very positive. This could be a very, very good thing to have in our community. And within a few days, the Salt Lake Tribune, the Deseret News picked up on it, and all the articles were extremely positive, extremely enthusiastic. So we still had 10 years to go, and we still had $1.5 million to raise, but we were moving in the right direction, and we had the vision. And all we really had to do was keep moving towards that vision that was on that piece of paper. Building momentum, getting supporters on board, sharing with them our enthusiasm and hopefully infecting them with a vision, a destination, a goal, and you please come on board and join us. for the journey. Maybe you have something in your life that you'd like to turn around. Maybe you're believing to restore an off-course child, a teenager that's made some bad decisions. How about this? Engrave their name on a copy of the Bhagavad Gita. And envision someday them sitting in this or a service in Salt Lake City with that Bhagavad Gita, with their engraved name on their lap. Maybe you want a child, and the child has not been forthcoming. How about going out and buying some baby clothes and hanging them in the closet where you see them several times a day? Maybe you're looking to lose some weight, so buy a smaller size dress and hang it in the bathroom where you see it coming and going. Perhaps you'd like to get admission to a college. Go ahead and buy the t-shirt. Wear the t-shirt around. Check out the course schedule. Buy some of the books that you're going to be studying when you get into that college and take those courses. All these are like planting seeds. Every time you're reminded of that baby, of that wayward teenager, of that college, and what ultimate destination you want, you're bringing it closer. It is said, with no vision, the people perish, they get stuck, they lose their passion. One of the major problems that faces in the West is we have no vision of God or His spiritual world. We haven't got a clue. Only there is speculation about the details of God and His abode. The default image that comes to most people's mind when they think of God in the Western countries is that old guy on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And I don't know about you, but my idea of fun is not to go and spend eternity with that guy. Sorry, that does not inspire me, does not push my buttons. God is not old, He could never be old, because He's eternal. He's eternal, that means He never dies. If He never dies, hello, He never gets old. Everyone who's ever gotten old has died. God doesn't die. Therefore, simple, elementary, it's not rocket science. Hello, Western culture. God is not old. He's young. He wears a peacock feather, a crown in his hair. He plays a flute. He's witty. He's attractive. He knows how to put on a festival, music, dancing. The spiritual world is a fantastic place. But because we don't have any vision, people perish. In India, there's a Krishna temple called Tirupati. And it's so popular, people have to wait in line up to 8 hours to get and to see the deity. And every time they move forward, which is about once every 10 minutes, they take a step forward, they say, go in the Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. Now that's enthusiastic. They want to go to the spiritual world, not tomorrow. They want to go to the spiritual world yesterday. A few years ago, my mother passed away in Pennsylvania, and so I went back to attend her memorial service. And I was chatting with the priest before we went out. And as devotees, we're excited about God. We always like to talk about God. And so we were talking, and I think he felt a little challenged by our conversation. So when he came out and he got up on the podium, he made his best effort to talk about the spiritual world. But the problem is, he had no information. He was just speculating. So he said, I think the spiritual world's like this, or I imagine it'd be like that. It was about as exciting as milk and crackers. I imagine most of the people in the audience were thinking, I would rather be on the golf course. Because no information. On the other hand, if you take advantage of the information that's available through the Vedic literature that Prabhupada delivered for us, Prabhupada said, we'll tell you what God looks like, we'll tell you where He lives, we'll tell you who His friends are, we'll tell you the names of His friends, we'll give you His address, and we'll give you His phone number. That's why the Hare Krishna devotees are mad after God. And they're surrounded by reminders of that ultimate destination. We can't see Krishna with these material eyes, but there is a scientific way of living this life in such a way that God can manifest Himself to you. It's called Bhakti Yoga, and it involves keeping the vision of the Lord before you at all times. One of the biggest impediments, I believe, to Westerners advancing in their knowledge and their intimacy with God often happens to be organized religion. Whenever you talk specifically about God, do you find that there's almost a knee-jerk reaction? That's got to be idol worship, that's got to be paganism. You're not supposed to be able to know God that specifically. And it's true. By our own research, by our own resources, we can't unveil the almighty, unlimited Lord who's beyond our senses. But He has revealed more information about Himself to us through the Vedic literatures than through any other literature. So why shouldn't we take advantage of it? For instance, here is the deity of Krishna, again, the darkish color playing the flute, and beside him is Radharani. This is not idol worship. These images are carved according to the descriptions of the scriptures, the visions of great saints and sages, and the worship of these deities has been going on for tens of thousands of years by hundreds of millions of people in India and now all over the world. And you know Indians, you know Indian people. They're computer whizzes, they're doctors, they're engineers. They're very, very educated, sophisticated people. They're not going to be worshiping idols since thousands and thousands of years. They're not primitive. They're not backward at all. What they're doing is scientifically approaching God through what's called the Archa Vigraha. And this form is not made up. It's not a figment of anyone's imagination. It is authorized. Take the post office box. It's orange and blue and says PMG on it. Now, there are many boxes. What's different about this box? It may look the same as so many other boxes. But why can you put your letter in that box with supreme confidence that it's going to get to its destination? Because that box is authorized by none other than the government of the United States of America. And if you're a teenager and you're out on Saturday night and you want to vandalize something with your friends, I would advise you that is the last thing you want to touch. Anything else you destroy is going to be under the municipal laws or the local laws or the county laws or the state laws. But if you vandalize, put a cherry bomb or smash it with a baseball bat, one of those boxes, that is a federal crime because it is authorized. So we remind ourselves of that place we want to go, that all blissful, ecstatic, eternal kingdom of God, where God is a transcendental, attractive youth, by keeping the deity form before us every day. Rising early in the morning and taking the beauty of the Lord into our heart. And as we go about raising our family, as we go to school, as we go to our office, we keep that image, that vision of the Lord in our heart throughout the day. Then when we come back at night, we're a little beat up with the association and the demand. Then again, we get darshan of the deity image of the Lord. And we go to bed at night dreaming of Krishna. So our process is always to keep the deity form before us. To keep the names of the Lord on our lips. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. To eat only food which has been consecrated by offerings to Krishna called prasadam. By when we clean, we think of Krishna. When we cook, we think of Krishna. When we do drama, we think of Krishna. All day long, before us, around us, Krishna, 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 Krishna. We even know how to throw a party for Krishna. Anybody been to the Festival of Commerce? Here Prabhupada says in the Srimad Bhagavatam, when the devotees orally receive the activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead as enacted in the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, they immediately achieve a transcendental vision in which they are no longer interested in materialistic activities, thus they achieve freedom from the material world. Let me share something with you. If you can accomplish your dreams with your own talents, your own resources, your own connections, then your dreams are too small. You've got to enlarge your vision. Your destiny is too great. Your assignment is too important to have little goals and little dreams and little plans. It's like in Japan. People are so densely packed in apartments, they don't even have a little plot of land to grow. So they've learned the art of miniaturization. In their apartments, they have these little tiny miniature trees. And I heard they even have mango trees in some apartments. Tiny, and they even produce fruits. But the fruits are tasteless. The fruits are useless. God is not asking us to miniaturize. He's asking us to maximize, to supersize our dreams. About 15 years ago in India, a devotee noticed that there was a lot of truancy in Indian schools. Because the kids were hungry. They would go to school hungry, and then they'd have to sit through 6 hours of classes getting hungrier and hungrier and hungrier all the time. They didn't have the nutrition with which to do good studies. And so they thought, what's the use? We'll just stay at home. So he had a dream of feeding kids all over India. He had no resources, he had no money, but he just wanted to start with a local school, cook something in a month, take it, and offer it as a midday meal. But he called the program, from its very inception, he called the program as Akshaya Patra. It refers to a pot which had been given to Draupadi in the Mahabharata by the sun god, which would give unlimited food to unlimited numbers of people. He had no money, no resources, no prospects, but he had a vision. And he called his program as Akshaya Patra. And eventually, other people saw the wisdom of his plan. They contributed. Every plate, every meal costs about 6 rupees. So in due course of time, he got 2 rupees for every meal from the private industry. The Hare Krishna movement gave 2 rupees, as well as the kitchens and the trucks and all to deliver. And the Indian government also gave 2 rupees. Of course, it takes them 3 years to pay, but anyway, eventually it comes. Today, that charity feeds 2 million children every day in India. Truancy is a thing of the past. Academic achievement has skyrocketed. One person with a big dream made a difference, and even he could probably have never even imagined how successful that would have come. God took his dream and took it even beyond what he could possibly imagine. So if you say, I can't imagine doing charitable work on that level, if you say, I can't imagine losing that kind of weight, or I can't imagine owning my own business, I can't imagine starting my own temple, you probably don't have to worry, because if you can't imagine it, it's not going to happen. It starts with an image. It actually starts with an image of it in your mind. So use your imagination to see yourself rising higher, accomplishing your dreams, overcoming your obstacles. See yourself as blessed. See yourself as prosperous and healthy and strong. I'm asking you not only to imagine a great future, but keep reminders in front of you of what Krishna has promised. Keep around you deities, devotees, pictures. Prabhupada called these windows to the spiritual world. The sacred food, prasadam, which is offered to Krishna. The Bhagavad Gita, Tulsi. The Tulsi bush should be around you. The spiritual world has a culture just like any other country, but this is a culture of the land where God lives and it's eternal, full of bliss and knowledge. Just a really quick, I told this story fully last week. And I'm not going to tell the whole story, but I'm just going to tell 1/4 of it. Last week we talked about Narada Muni, a transcendental spaceman who travels around meeting 4 types of people and benedicting each person in the best way that he could. So he met a butcher, he met a king, he met a yogi, and finally he met a devotee. So he said to the devotee, live or die, it doesn't matter. Whether you live or die, it doesn't. He actually benedicted the king to live a long life because he was all involved in hedonism and sensuality, and in his next life he'd become a dog. So he said to the king, live long. He said to the devotee, to the yogi, die, because you've already given up all material attachments, so you might as well die and achieve your liberation. He said to the butcher, don't live, don't die, because his occupation was so sinful that every day he lived, he was killing more animals, and when he would die, then for every hair on the back of every animal, he would have to take birth as an animal and go to the slaughterhouse. But when he came to a devotee, he said, live or die, it doesn't matter, because what you're doing now, you will be doing those self-same things in the spiritual world. So there's no difference between now and then. In bhakti yoga, the end and the means are the same. We serve Krishna in order to serve him better, more lovingly, more intimately in the future. I had a quick trip to Los Angeles last week. Cal Poly Pomona, they wanted to do a colors fest, and they ordered several thousand bags of colors from me. But their funding didn't come through. So it was Monday, and their festival was Thursday, and they were going to have to pay an extra $1,000 for UPS second day. So I had to go to LA to pick up a cooker that they prepared for us and some tents. So I said, okay, if you'll pay me the $400 standard UPS ground plate, that'll cover me being able to rent a pickup truck and the gas, and I can do my business, and I can drop the colors off Thursday morning, the morning of your festival. So that went well. When I was in LA picking up the cooker, I ran into an old friend of mine named Gopal Bhatta. He was just getting something in the restaurant. We bumped into each other. I gave him a hug. And I haven't seen him for a while, probably a year or so. Last time we saw him, he had put on some weight. So this time, he was probably about 35 pounds thinner. So I said, "Well, you're looking good. You've lost some weight." So instead of being pleased, he frowned. He looked at me. He didn't say anything for a long time. And he said, "I've got 5 stents in my heart." I thought, okay. And then he smiled. And he said, "But I'm not going to get scared. I'm not going to get defeatist. I'm not going to get morbid. I'm not going to have a pity party." He said something that struck in my mind. I wanted to share it with you. He said, "I'm going to live while dying. I'm going to live while dying." And how many people do you know who don't have a vision, who don't have an ambition, who don't have a goal for the future, who are otherwise healthy? They've got all the resources, but because they don't have a vision, they're dying while they're living. Make plans. Your family, your country, your church, they need you. When we first started construction of the temple in 1998, medical science gave my Bobby 2 years to live. But she had a great vision to honor God. And that vision carried her not only through the many, many years of construction and fundraising, but here it is. The temple has been open 12 years and she's still going strong. It's never over until God says it's over. If you keep God first place, the future will always be better than the past. If you know victory is assured, if you know there's a place reserved for you in the eternal kingdom of God, you're living a life of victory. And that vision of victory will spill over and translate into every one of your daily activities as well. Whether it's a matter of losing weight or restoring your health or getting out of debt, restoring a teenager, resolving a legal issue, you'll approach each and every one of these challenges as a winner and not a loser, as a loaner and not a borrower. You'll know that whatever you touch will succeed and prosper. I love this poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson. "Sunset and evening star and one clear call for me, and may there be no moaning of the bar when I put out to sea. But such a tide as moving seems asleep, too full for sound and foam, when that which drew from out the boundless deep returns again home. For though from out are born of time and place, the flood may bear me far, I hope to see my pilot face to face when I have crossed the bar." It is said that whatever you can see, Krishna will give you. So the problem is, people are stuck because they've got their heads down. All they can think about is their problems. All they can look about is their feet. And that's all they get. You get what you see. If all you can see is problems, inadequacies, defeatism, negativism, then you will inherit all those things. Whatever you see, you'll inherit. Krishna says, look up. Look beyond your immediate problems. Look at where you want to be. The beauty of looking up is that then your vision is panoramic and Krishna will give you everything that you can see. Oftentimes we hear that blessings, favor, come to those who are upright. And upright means who have integrity, who have honesty. But it also literally means those who are upright, who are looking at where they want to go. And everything they see, everything they can imagine, everything they dream is given to them because they have a vision. If you have a big vision, Krishna will do big things in your life. He'll release His favor like you've never seen before. He can take you to places that you could never go on your own. He's going to take your big dreams and even supersize them. He's going to open doors that no man can shut. You need to get ready. Every dream, every promise, every goal that Krishna has placed in your heart, it will come to pass. Thank you very much for your kind attention. And if you'd like to chant with me, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.